You're now listening to the Inside Out Podcast with Jimmy Hunt. Get it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Inside Out with Jimmy Hunt, your podcast destination for all things mental fitness. And today I have the wonderful Alison Gabeau with me. Alison is a licensed therapist with four degrees. She's a confidence and self-worth coach and international speaker specializing in anxiety, trauma, and sex and intimacy. And I could talk to her about all of those specialties, and I may just have to have her back to do that. But today I want to delve deep with her on high functioning anxiety. Welcome to the podcast, Alison.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
So my listeners know, but you do not, that for the last 9 years, I have taken a sign to public places, and my sign says, chat with me, free advice, conversations, and listening. And I just sit and be for those people and help if they want it or just listen. And over those 9 years, I've spoken to literally thousands of people and a vast array of interesting and crazy stories have come along. But there are definitely themes that have run through. And especially in my location right now, I have predominantly sort of 25 to 35-year-olds trying to escape what really is high-functioning anxiety. They've all got anxiety. They don't understand it. They don't know how to deal with it. And they basically tend to assimilate it and go, well, this is my life now. And because my location is a beach in southern Mexico, a lot of them are running away to try and figure it out, and they're looking for answers. So I'm going to start with a simple but loaded question for you, Alison. What is high-functioning anxiety, and where does it come from?
Yeah, great question. So I always like to give just a little tad of a background on just what is anxiety so we can have a little bit of a contrast. And so, you know, I think if you ask 100 different therapists, they'll describe it 100 different ways. But the way that I describe anxiety is that ultimately it's a fear response, and it's usually a perceived fear. Right. So it isn't this overt fear where someone is chasing us or there's some imminent danger. It's a story that we've created inside of our own brain that feels really scary. And I think when we think about anxiety, the most common archetype, you know, sort of what we think of it as, is someone who's having a panic attack, someone who can't show up to work, someone who's having trouble breathing. And that is all anxiety for sure. But what separates high functioning anxiety from that other stuff is really, it's much deeper. And I almost like to say it's like a sneak attack, right? So someone with high functioning anxiety is not, you know, sitting in bed or having panic attacks. What is usually happening is their internal monologue is just trash. And they're telling themselves all sorts of awful things on a regular basis. I always kind of describe it as, it's the people who look like they have it together, right? And the tricky part about high functioning anxiety is your narrative is terrible. It's telling you I'm not good enough. I need to work harder. I need to show up. I need to earn my worth. But a lot of the times those people are actually successful, right? Because they are the ones that show up early. They are the ones that stay late. They are the ones that say yes to everything. They have poor boundaries. So, you know, outwardly, they look like these powerhouse people who have it all together. But internally, there's just this unbelievable struggle. Right? There's not a lot of fulfillment in what they're doing because their hustle is really coming from pressure and not from passion.
I like it. I think it's well explained. And this sort of falls into, you know, my entire realm of mental fitness is because labels can be quite detrimental. And a lot of people will be like, oh, I'm not anxious. I don't have anxiety. Like, I just am stressed all the time and I just don't like myself and all of these sorts of things. And I think I liked what you said there around the fact that the reality really sort of boils down to, in my view, the fact that a lot of people have a low self-worth. And the, as you said, the talk in your head is trash.
Mm-hmm.
So if we've got trash talk in our head, what can we do to work around that?
Yeah. So, you know, I think the first step to any mental health, mental fitness is awareness, right? And it sort of feels like a cop-out answer. Right.
But no, it's not. Just... it's literally the first thing on my framework.
Yes.
Absolutely.
You know, you have to start to bring attention to it or nothing will change. So, you know, a lot of the times when I'm working with clients, I will do things that kind of bring awareness to it without kind of catching them off guard. And the example I'll give you is they'll walk in and I'll say, "Hey, Susie, I love your hair." Right. And so often someone with high functioning anxiety will say something like, "Oh, wait, my hair. Oh, I haven't even brushed it today." Right. Yeah. And it's not this overt sentence of like, "I am not good enough." I think if you have that type of awareness, like, good for you, but most of us don't, we're saying some sort of more subtle versioning of that. Right. "Oh, my hair isn't cute enough. I can't get a good date. No one likes me." We walk into a room, we're, you know, overthinking the conversation that we had with someone at a party because we maybe are worried that we weren't interesting. Right. So it's much more subtle than just like, "I am telling myself I am not worthy." And so, you know, I want someone to sort of almost create a thought inventory, like really start to think, what am I actually telling myself? Right. I'm laying, especially overthinkers and high functioning anxiety often go together. So when you're laying in bed at night, what are you thinking? Right. Are you thinking, "Wow, I nailed that today. I really, you know, did great at work. I'm a great mom." Or are you like, "Oh, you know, shit, I got to wake up earlier. I got to make sure I get to the office early. I can't believe that I screwed up the bake sale." Right? That's going to be a good indication of your self-talk. What is the tone, right? So that's usually step one. I just want to bring awareness to the tone in which you are speaking to yourself.
I really sort of try and help people with exactly that. Dispelling of compliments is a form of a lack of self-worth. Because we always just downplay the compliments that people give us. And I just teach people that there is one simple answer and response to any compliment, and you just have to learn it. And then you have to apply it. And you have to catch yourself as if you default to that negative or brushing off of that compliment, you go back to this, you know, two-word response that I'll teach everybody now. It can be a little complicated and it takes a little bit of time to implement, but I think you should all learn it now. And the two words are "thank you."
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. That's exactly
thank
right.
You. That's it. All you have to say is "thank you."
That is it. Right. And if you think about it yourself, how often do we inauthentically give a compliment? Like, yeah, all right, maybe sometimes occasionally to our boss, but generally speaking, if we're giving someone a compliment, it's genuine, right? It's not a common experience to manipulate that, right? So, you know, part of overcoming high functioning anxiety, learning a new self-talk is learning how to receive, right? Receive compliments, receive, you know, awareness to that you do inherently have worth. Right. And that's great. Yeah. Just simple as that. Right. We don't have to make it more complicated. Thank you. Good enough.
Exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, you've worked with a diverse clientele over the years, just like I've spoken to a diverse amount of people on the beach and stuff, and everything from the overachievers like you talked about, all the way through to non-traditional therapy spaces like the beach.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you see high functioning anxiety manifest differently across these groups? And are there any like misconceptions that we can dispel about that?
Yeah, you know, so I mean, I like what you said about being on the beach and you know, escapism, right? So high functioning anxiety, commonly, you know, the common denominator, as we're discussing, has poor self-talk, but there's all sorts of behaviors that can show up differently. So, you know, escapism, and that can look like, I need to just run to Mexico and take a vacation and just check out for my life. It can be in more destructive ways than that, right? We can have substance use, we can have, you know, all sorts of damaging things. Again, that's sort of a note to pull away from life because we haven't figured out a way to handle it. Often high functioning anxiety comes with perfectionism, right? So someone who might be experiencing this type of anxiety might have a lot of high expectations of themselves. And actually, there's quite a lot of research around the correlation between perfectionism and procrastination, right? So like, if I can't do something perfectly, I don't want to do it, right? So it shows up differently across different people. It's really, again, pulling back to, I love somatic psychology, drop into your body, how does things feel, right? Yeah. If I'm on a beach in Mexico and drinking a margarita, am I having the greatest time ever? Am I still holding on to stress? Right. If I'm not showing up to a project because I'm procrastinating because I think I can't do it if it's not perfect, how does that feel in my heart? Does it feel motivating or does it feel suffocating? Okay. And so the actual behaviors in which a person showcases when they have this kind of anxiety does look different across different populations for sure.
Yeah, I think you're right there in the terms of the escapism, the running away to the beach in Mexico and then seeing how you feel is really important, because if you run away and you feel content and happy, then there's probably something in your other environment that is making you sick. If you run away, like so many of these people do, and land next to me at the beach, the anxiety hasn't gone away. That's when they get really scared. That's when they realize that escapism isn't an answer for them. They need to do something, but they don't know what. And so for the person that has run away to the beach, realized that escapism isn't working for them, still those thoughts have chased them all the way here. They sit and they feel that tension and they feel that fear. What is the next step for them after awareness? They're now very aware that they're talking to themselves like shit. They're very aware that they're holding this tension and this fear and this pain. What is step two to allowing them to move through this cycle?
Yeah. So, you know, no one likes it when I give this answer, but I'm going to give it anyway. You know, reminding yourself that you're in control of your own life. I think so much of anxiety comes from the idea that we're not in control. We feel out of control. And when we can connect to the decisions I am making are mine and mine alone to make, that can be terrifying, right? Especially if we have longstanding jobs, if we have partners, if we have children. With that said, right, it's also really liberating. And so if you want to kind of like baby bite it, right, I would say first awareness and then just start to actively change your self-talk. But I think the real change comes when we're really looking at our lives and seeing what formula needs to be shifted. And I give a little bit of my story here. I do have 4 degrees, and I love doing mental health work. I love doing all of this stuff, but somehow I found myself in a very high powered job. I was a private investigator and I worked for corporate investigations and I, you know, made it very high up the ladder. I was right under the CEO of the company. I was meeting with all these huge lawyers. From the outside, it looked like I had it all together. And inside I was just struggling. I didn't care about my job. I didn't enjoy it. And I was sitting in a meeting one day and I just had this giant awareness that I didn't hate my life, but I was not happy in my life. I was constantly escaping in all sorts of different ways. And that's the last day I was at that meeting. And when I tell that story, I often get the response of, you know, yeah, good for you. I'm sure you had all these other all this backup plan lined up. And the truth is, I absolutely did not. I've never had parental support financially. I was living on my own. I was in a New York City apartment. I had $260,000 worth of student loan debt. And I just knew that I could continue on the path that was leading towards the wall, right? Or I could come off of it. And, you know, that's when I went to get my fourth degree. I had to go back to school to get my license, all the education that I had beforehand. It didn't amount to anything anymore. The state had changed the laws. I had to go back for a fourth degree. And, you know, lucky me. And yeah. I had to take an unpaid internship in my mid-30s, right? Not the hottest ticket in town to have to do that. And I begged a friend of mine to let me bartend for happy hour at an outrageously, you know, less money than I was used to making. And the reason that I tell that story is because that is the day that I took my control back. So it doesn't have to be that extreme, right? I'm not suggesting that it's everyone's answer to suddenly abandon their life. But the awareness can't just stop at I'm having bad self-talk. It really has to pull back, look at your whole life and think, where am I happy? Where am I not happy? How can I tweak this? And sometimes it just means, for me, it meant full abandonment. I had to leave, right? That can happen in relationships too. I just need to break up. I just need to move. But it can also happen on a subtler level. Maybe we just need boundaries here. Maybe we just need better communication, better assertion. But awareness needs to be met with action, right? So it isn't enough to just be aware. That's just the starting point, a beautiful starting point. But then that's where the effort starts to come in.
Cool. I want to get to the action piece in a second, but there's a few things in there I want to pick out and have a chat to you about.
Yeah.
And the first is the understanding that you create your own reality, that choices are yours to make. Now, you might not get to choose everything, but you at least get to choose how to react to everything. Yes. And that can be quite problematic for a lot of people, because if they fall into the understanding that their choices created their reality, that means that their current shit reality is their fault. And they don't want it to be their fault.
Yeah.
So I see a lot of people get scared around that. Part of it.
They do. And that's why I always start with, like, people don't like to hear that part. And I would get gentle on the, it's my fault, right? So, you know, the way that I would ask someone to sort of reframe that is, you know, I didn't know what I didn't know until I knew it. We make decisions based on the information, you know, information we have. Sometimes we pick a partner and we're like, wow, this person seems great for me. We don't see all the red flags at first, right?
Yeah.
That job that I took helped me financially. You know, 6 years down the line, it was really contributing to my burnout, right? So it wasn't that it was the wrong decision, or I don't have to go back and fault myself. But it's like, hey, part of my growth and evolution is reflection, right? Okay, so that was working for me 6 years ago. How is it working for me right now? And if the answer is like, hey, it's not working, that's where we can reclaim that empowerment and say, like, okay, I am in charge of this. I can make different choices. Right? That doesn't mean that it's not hard, right? That's the point that I always like to beat. It is hard. It is hard to change our circumstances, whether we're leaving a partner, leaving a job, moving to a new city, any of it. But, you know, in therapy, we say pick your heart. And staying in a life that is constantly making you exhausted, burnt out, anxious, unhappy, that's pretty effing hard.
Yeah, no, absolutely it is. And I love the way you reframe that there, because I also like the understanding that it also matters not what decisions came before that. We are here and we are here now, and we have an opportunity to make a new decision from this moment on. And we can continue to make that new decision that will lead us to places where we haven't been before, hopefully happier and healthier places. I want to touch quickly on the flip side of that as well, which is the victim mentality space, and that this is happening to me.
Yeah.
You got a good reframe for that one?
You know, things do happen to us, right? That is true, right? With that said, like, I liked what you said, and I would echo the same, right? There are things that will happen to us. There are things that we did not get to choose. But at the end of the day, we always have the choice and control in our response. So, you know, there is, I call it my big three, right? Creativity, flexibility, and patience. If we put all these three bad boys into the circumstance, there is always a way out. So, you know, no one is just a victim to their circumstances. Maybe we need support. Maybe we need to ask for help. Maybe we need, there's ways to get creative here, right? Yeah. Again, back to, it's hard to make these bold choices, these bold changes, but we always have some power and some control, right? So I always imagine like a big circle, right? Put everything inside of the circle that you actually have control over, right? Yep. There are going to be some things outside of the circle, right? Maybe I can't, you know, I'm not in the financial place to just quit my job and move out. Okay. Yep. Can I create a plan for, you know, what do I need to make this a future plan, right? Yep. Even if just setting those intentions starts to shift our mindset, things start to become easier. Some of that anxiety gets released.
Yeah. All right, moving on to the action piece, right? You have expertise in CBT, DBT, yes. EMDR.
All the letters.
Yeah. Can you explain how these techniques, you know, address high-functioning anxiety and maybe even share like a, you know, a breakthrough or a success story or something like that that you've witnessed?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, those are three of my main specialties. So CBT is just a fancy way to say that our thoughts dictate our emotions, which dictate our behaviors. So if I think that I'm not good enough or attractive, that's going to make me feel insecure. And that insecurity is going to power me maybe to have low expectations for my partner, right? Yeah. So if we reformulate our thoughts, right, thinking again back to that thought inventory, what are we actually telling ourselves? We can start to reframe it and that'll sort of trickle through the rest of it. So I love that for high functioning anxiety, because again, it's so powered by what we're telling ourselves, that narrative. I always say like, let's ditch the narratives, replace them, right? We have to make space for new things, but that means letting go of things that aren't working anymore. DBT, it was traditionally used for people with personality disorders, but you can use it in high functioning anxiety. And the piece that I always pull out is mindfulness. There's a whole section of mindfulness. And, you know, I think mindfulness gets a misconception here. When I say that to people, they think I'm going to ask them to meditate or do yoga. And that can be mindful. But mindfulness in a psychological sort of space, all it means is noticing what's happening without judgment, right? That judgment piece kills us, right? If I'm thinking, I can't believe I'm still struggling with my feelings of, I want to be body positive, for instance, but I'm still struggling with this. I'm still wanting to weigh myself, right? That, and then we think, and I can't believe how, you know, I'm not far enough along. That shame on the second piece kills the first piece. Anytime we're bringing judgment and shame into something, squashes any growth, right?
Yeah, so mindfulness, okay. So on, yeah. on that as a question then,
yeah,
like how do we, like, so if we, because you, I mean, you said, you know, you don't get people to do meditation, yoga, whatever, but the, you know, the basis of meditation is the observation of your thoughts in a non-judgmental way. And yeah. So the thing that people struggle with is the non-judgmental way part.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so how, if we get to the observation state, how do we become non-judgmental to it?
You know, I think, so noticing what we're thinking, but then honestly changing that tone. So I sort of joke about this, but I say, like, I now talk to myself the way I talk to my dog, right? I'm never mean to my dog. He's the best. So, yeah. You know, just the way in which you are speaking to yourself, right? Yeah. Starts to show judgment, right?
Yep. Like a child.
Like a child.
You can't judge a five-year-old.
You can't, right? Yeah. I had a therapist once tell me, and I thought this was super helpful, just say, this is what it feels like to be. Right? This is what it feels like to be anxious right now. This is what it feels like to be jealous of my partner right now. This is what it feels like to feel FOMO, right?
Yeah.
We don't have to interpret the feeling. We can just speak it. It just exists.
Yeah. But the other side of that, which is a brilliant piece of advice from that person, is that the observation of the feeling makes it temporary. Mm-hmm. When you claim the feeling, I am anxious, then congratulations, you are. And yes, you will hold on to that for as long as you claim it.
Yeah, absolutely. I love Buddhism. That's not my religion or spirituality, but I love it from like a psychological point. So, and they have a tenet, which is the idea of impermanence. And all it means is basically this too shall pass, right? You're going to have awesome moments in your life. guess what? Those are going to end. But knowing that also means that when we're sitting in anxiety or grief or depression or loneliness, right, that's going to move too, right? Every feeling ebbs and flows. And just constantly reminding ourselves makes all of our feelings more tolerable.
Right? Yeah. I want to get to that shame part that you brought up there, but I just have one quick question, which you can answer in a couple of seconds because we can't really get into it in this, but is EMDR, do you recommend that for people with high functioning anxiety?
Yeah, you know, EMDR is typically used for trauma, but it on a lower level can be used for anything. It's just, you know, pacing your thoughts, again, bringing that awareness to it and getting to rewrite it in a safe space. So EMDR really has a lot of applications. I use it very, very lightly. I don't do this like big, big bad sessions, but I incorporate it in. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So about that shame and guilt piece. So how do those emotions like intertwine with that high functioning anxiety? And what are the best strategies to help alleviate that shame and guilt that we're so good at just helping heaping onto ourselves?
Oh, we really are, right? So the thing about shame is it doesn't change that emotion, as we kind of discussed. And so I'm thinking like, okay, let's name an emotion that pretty much everybody, or a feeling state, a state of being that everyone knows, being hungry. If I'm like, damn it, I just ate, I shouldn't be hungry anymore, that does not take away your hunger, right?
Yeah.
If I'm like, damn it, I just peed, I shouldn't have to pee, it doesn't take away that need. And that's how our emotional states work too. So if we're feeling, you know, an example I'll give is something like, I can't believe my partner's going out with a coworker, I'm feeling jealous, I shouldn't, I trust them. Right. It's like, well, what did that do? It actually doesn't allow us to sit with the jealousy. Right. Now we're just feeling suffocated. Anytime we're using the words I should or I shouldn't, we're typically off base. Those are like very check engine lights. They do not help us process emotions. Full stop.
That's a great actionable tip. Like that is, we'll pull that out right here, right now for everybody. We'll stop just a second. Listeners, listen to that one. If you say I should or I shouldn't, then you are typically off base.
Yeah.
And you need to check in back with that.
Yes. Absolutely.
I like it. And so when, let's deepen that just a touch.
Yeah.
So I say I should or I shouldn't. I am aware of that. And so my action, just to clarify, my action is to restate or reframe. Is that what you would suggest?
Yeah, I would restate without the should, right? I'm feeling jealous today. That's just what's going on, right?
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
We don't need to interpret it. That's just like, you know, again, it's going to pass. We get to think like, okay, well, why am I feeling jealous? We can actually do deeper work then, right? Maybe I'm feeling insecure. Maybe I need a little more love. Maybe I just need to communicate that I need more affection, whatever it is, right? We can now make an action step if we're actually looking at what we're feeling. If we're judging it, if we're shooting, I shouldn't feel that way. We're at an impasse. There's nowhere to go, right? We get lost there. Guilt sucks. Shame sucks. Doesn't work.
Yeah. And so if I am feeling jealous and I sit there and I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm feeling jealous. And I sort of delve into it and I go, why am I feeling jealous? Well, I don't really know. I'm just feeling jealous.
Mm-hmm.
What's the suggestion there? Is it just to keep observing until that feeling subsides, or do you need to go into a deeper dive to try and uncover it?
I would absolutely go into a deeper dive, right? I don't think the work stops with awareness. And so, you know, this is where I get like, I'm biased as hell, I'm a therapist, right? But this is where sometimes we need support, because there's going to be questions that can lead you to those answers. But some, you know, it's really hard for us to be subjective to our own lives or objective to our own lives. So if you are a super insightful and reflective person that comes highly naturally to you, oh, then you can probably get there on your own. Sometimes, you know, there's journal prompts that are available online, right? But typically we need to bounce this, right? Find you at a beach and say, hey, I'm feeling jealous. And hopefully you'll be able to prompt some responses. But that's usually just where we need some gentle help.
Yeah, because we're not very self-aware. There have been many, many, many studies done that have proved that we are really shit at being self-aware. Terrible. And so external self-awareness, that ability to have somebody else prompt and point stuff out to you, is really key. And as you probably know, like the work of Tasha Urich is very good in this space. And something of hers that I talk about a lot is the idea of a loving critic, somebody who you have a mutual level of respect for, who has your best interests at heart, and who is willing to tell you the truth.
Absolutely.
Get those three things in somebody and they can definitely help you deepen that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's so many resources, right? So, you know, you can obviously talk to a therapist, perfect, like loving critic of a friend, right? If you have group memberships that you are part of, you know, people can lean towards spirituality. Like there is access points into finding support. It's just most of us, we're terrible at self-awareness and self-insight. It's so, you know, lovingly bouncing it off someone, such a critical step.
Big part of my podcast, every third episode is a relationship episode.
Yeah.
And one of your areas of expertise is sex and intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if you could just talk to how does high functioning anxiety impact on relationships, sex, intimacy, and what sort of advice do you have for couples navigating these challenges? And I suspect a lot of the listeners will be sitting here going, yep, my partner. And how can you not only navigate it from the anxious person's perspective, but the partner trying to deal with it?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, anybody who's suffering from high functioning anxiety, this is going to show up in their entire life. So the type of person who shows up early to work, doesn't, you know, leaves late, has poor boundaries answering their email, they're going to be very people pleasing in their relationships as well. And ultimately, if we are people pleasing with our partner, that's one way that anxiety shows up. We're not doing either one of us a service, right? Because one, I'm not advocating for my own needs, but then two, I'm not letting my partner meet them authentically. So that's one way that it can absolutely show up in partnerships, is like poor boundaries and people pleasing. Alternatively, some people with high functioning anxiety have, you know, we're the worst to the people we're the closest to, right? So you might have it totally together in the boardroom. You might be having it totally together at the PTA and come home and all that anxiety just like floods out. And it, even though you're a person who is high functioning, the output of anxiety inside of a relationship can often be really, you know, volatile. And so that's really important too. And that's the two different ways that I see it show up. I'm sure there's more variety here, but those are probably the two most common. Like, I am so scared to tell my partner what I like in bed because I don't want to reject him. So therefore I just will have crappy sex my whole life. Right. But isn't that better? Yeah. I mean, I'm struggling internally, but I can't say it out loud. Right. Or someone who's kind of, you know, having more of overt panic.
Yeah. I did an episode on mojoupgrade.com.
Okay.
Come across that website?
No, I haven't.
It's literally just a couple that coded it together. Okay. And, but the people that I've talked to have done it, it really helped them overcome the anxiety. So what you basically do is I sign up and there's something like 180 questions.
Ooh.
And you say like, yes, I want to do it. No, I don't want to do it. Yes, but only if my partner does, or we already do it. So those are the questions. So I fill in it all.
Okay.
And then I put my partner's email in. It gets sent to her. She then answers all of the questions and it spits out a report, but it only spits out the answers when you both said yes to, or one said yes to and the other said, if my partner wants it.
Brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant.
And so very simple concept, But very brilliant, because what happens is if it comes up and you've both wanted to do it, you're like, oh, yay. I've been so afraid to bring up the fact that I want you to do this to me or I want to do that to you.
Yeah.
And that was just a very practical way to remove some of the anxiety about sexual intimacy.
Yeah. And shame, right? So
yeah,
I find,
shame. Yeah, absolutely shame.
So many people just, they're scared to tell their partners for fear of being judged. And that's usually where shame comes from, and fear of being judged. So yeah, it takes away that. That's gorgeous. Love it.
So would one of your suggestions be, I'm putting words in your mouth, be like communication in a relationship in order to reduce anxiety?
I mean, absolutely. Right. So, you know, again, our behaviors speak very loudly, but we're often not actually saying what we mean, right? If I'm just coming into the room and being irritable, I might not be saying, hey, I'm jealous, right? So our behaviors always are speaking to our emotions, but it is so much better if we actually just speak to our emotions. And the most standard way to do this, right, the formula for communication with our partner is I sentences, I sentences, I sentences. The moment you start with a you sentence, it doesn't matter if you and I have no idea who the other is, we immediately get defensive, right? So it's just, that's just programmed. So I feel blank when you blank, what I need is blank. And it's uncomfortable. It sounds really awkward, but that is like, if you're looking for practical advice, trying that, period, right?
Absolutely. That is the number one piece of practical advice there. I completely agree. And that is what I am looking for here, because so many people end up in these places and they're just like, what do I do? And so what sort of actionable advice, almost, do you have like a framework that you would run people through to go, hey, I'm high functioning, but I'm anxious and everything's crazy right now and I don't know how to deal with it and I feel all these ways. Do you have like steps that you would put people through that would allow them to start the process of going through and learning to reduce this anxiety by themselves?
By themselves? Yeah, sure. So, you know, I'm a nerd for brain science. And I very strongly believe the more we think something about ourselves, the more baseline it becomes. A practical example I give is like, imagine yourself driving from point A to point B, someplace you go regularly. Imagine you're going to work, your kid's school, whatever. You don't think much about how you get from point A to point B, right?
No.
You don't think much about how you brush your teeth. This is how our brain works. So if we've been telling ourselves, I'm not good enough, I need to care more about my partner's needs than I do in bed, whatever it may be, that is where the place you're making from all of those decisions, right? All the decisions that lead in your life. So if you want to take by yourself actively switching them, it takes effort and practice. And the practical advice that I give clients is every single day, I want a minimum commitment of 45 straight days, right? When you brush your teeth, please brush your teeth. Right. When you brush your teeth and you're standing in front of the mirror, I want you to say, I don't care what, but literally anything kind to yourself. And, you know, if you can't, if you're not creative and it sounds too hard and you feel like you're faking it, that's fine. But it's the practice of changing.
Just say, I love you.
I love you.
Just say, I love you.
Right. Something you're grateful for. Like, it doesn't have to be something big and bold. Right. Yeah. I love you. I'm good enough. I am capable. I am worthy. I mean, in this day and age, you can literally Google this stuff and find like a list of affirmations, but it's the idea of switching that neural pathway. And if suddenly you couldn't get from point A to point B to work and you had to take a detour, right? The first few times that would be difficult for you, eventually it would become easy. And that's how your brain works. So the more you start to actively practice this, the more this magic will happen. And when I say this to people, they're like, seriously, that's your big pitch. All of these degrees, that's the thing. I'm supposed to look in the mirror and say, I like myself. But fundamentally, the answer is yes. And, you know, the clients, the wins that I have seen, right? I have a client, like quick client win. She was in a poor relationship. She hated her job, right? When I met her 6 years ago, not in a great place. Currently, she's in a kick-ass relationship. She has her own business. She is just like nailing life. And the thing we did was practice this, right?
Yeah.
Over enough time when she's like, I can have the life that I want, she got it, right? She got it. But it had to start with your thoughts. Your thoughts dictate your emotions, which dictate your behaviors. So we got to start there. Active practice, 45 days.
Yeah. So that's classic neuroplasticity. It sounds like absolute wishy-washy bullshit.
I know.
That is the biggest hurdle for the average person to get across. But like you said, you are a brain science geek. And if you don't believe Allison, just go read all the fucking studies. They are exactly all there and they back up exactly what she says. And just saying nice things in the mirror is not going to do anything. It fucking does.
It does.
And it has. And it will for you as well. And it's almost like a thing I find when I get people to do things like that is that they almost have an embarrassment piece to it.
Yeah.
And the funny thing, they're embarrassed of themselves.
Yeah.
Which just goes back to a self-worth issue, which means you need to do that even more than you already do.
Yeah, exactly that, right? And it feels embarrassing because it's awkward and we haven't been taught it, right? Yeah. But I like people to think about, like, think of whoever your mentor is, whoever your role model is, right? What do they exude? They probably exude confidence, right?
Yeah.
And confidence comes internally. So you can have that too. It's just effortful. So, you know, yeah, do yourself a favor, get over the awkwardness, accept it's going to be awkward. Don't shame it. And you can do it privately. No one has to know that this is your business, right? You're in the bathroom brushing your teeth. It's cool. You know, don't tell anybody. Yep. It's fine.
The percentage of the population that cannot look themselves in the eye, in the mirror, and say, I love you, is disturbing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I challenge everyone listening to this now to next time they pass a mirror, go up to it, pick an eye, and just stare into your soul and say, I love you. And see if you can do that freely or if it makes you feel ridiculously uncomfortable. And then if it makes you feel uncomfortable, ask yourself, why is loving myself so hard?
Yeah.
Do I not deserve to? If anyone's going to love me, do I not deserve that I love me?
Yeah.
And if you can't answer that question, then do what Allison says, at least 45 days in the mirror.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. 45 days, we build it. The science tells us that's how we need at least that long to build a habit.
At least. Yeah. Yeah. So because you're a big brain science geek, here's a question for you. Looking ahead, mm-hmm. are there any developments or innovations in this field that we're in that you're particularly excited about?
You know, it's a great question. I don't know that I immediately have the answer. I guess what I'm excited about is a more generic answer, which is just the fact that this message is becoming popular, right?
Yeah.
And I give credit to social media. Social media can be a hellscape. With that said, there are a lot of people coming forward and not only acknowledging their struggles, but acknowledging how they've moved past them, right? And so the fact that even someone understands the word neuroplasticity, that's 6 years ago, I think nobody would understand what I'm talking about. And now we do have a framework for it. So, you know, I don't think we need to recreate the wheel here. It's just really investing in the things that we know to work is good enough for me.
Yeah, no, I like that too, because it's kind of my answer. I always say that if all research, science, and everything were to stop today, it wouldn't actually impact the improvement of our mental health because we have everything we could possibly need right now. The problem is the actioning of those solutions.
Yeah.
And it is, and I agree with you, I'm most excited. I've been in this field, you know, speaking and helping for almost 13 years now. And when I used to speak at businesses back in the day, they would bring me in the back door and be like, don't tell anybody you were here because other companies or might think that they have a mental health problem, and which is why they had to get this guy in. Whereas now you walk in the door and they're like, quick, lots of pictures for our social media. But that is how far the landscape has changed in a decade. And I find that exciting. Absolutely. Yeah. Agree with you.
Absolutely.
One last question for you, Alison. Do you happen to have a personal mantra or philosophy that guides you in your mental fitness journey?
I sure do. My mantra I say to myself almost every day is my anxiety lies. Period. Yeah. Right? When I'm hearing those thoughts, good reminder, it's a terrible predictor of what's going to happen. It's just a bully, and it ain't telling me, it's telling me tall tales. So I like that one for anyone who's suffering from poor self-talk or even more low functioning anxiety.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. Our brain lies to us constantly. Mm-hmm. Oh, and that's where the observation of the thoughts with non-judgment allow us to start making better choices about what are lies and what are actual truths.
Yeah.
Precisely. Alison, thank you for everything today. Is there anywhere where people can come find out more about you, go follow you? Where do we go?
Yeah, my website is anotefromyourtherapist.com. And I am under, you know, the social media, Instagram world under the same name, A Note From Your Therapist. And I have my own podcast as well called Becoming Unstoppable, specifically talking to women who struggle with high functioning anxiety, shame in the bedroom, all that stuff we face. And that's available on, you know, all the places you find your podcasts.
All of the places. Thank you very much, Alison. I appreciate you coming. And I'm sure everyone's walked away with a whole bunch of things today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate having me.
That was Inside Out with Jimmy Hunt. See you next time.